You're listening to Voices from the 2008 ACLU Membership Conference. I'm Matt Dellinger, and joining me now is Glenn Greenwald, who is a former constitutional and civil rights litigator, and now a writer, a contributing writer at Salon. He writes the political and legal blog Unclaimed Territory, and he's the author of two New York Times bestselling books, How Would a Patriot Act? And A Tragic Legacy. Welcome, Glenn.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Now, I'm interested by the fact that you were a civil rights litigator in New York City before becoming a writer. Why would you go from being an actual litigator to, I guess, what many journalists would say is sort of a, you know, the bleachers?
Well, I actually look at it as the other way around, I guess.
Really?
For a long time, I was relatively apolitical. I mean, I followed political events. But in general, thought that the priority was to defend our constitutional framework, which I thought I could do best by litigating constitutional cases when people's civil rights were being abridged. And so that was what I was doing. And around 2002, 2003, I started to reach the conclusion that a lot of people reached, which was that for the first time in at least several decades, we were not just violating civil liberties in a discrete case-by-case basis, but we're really departing from them in a fundamental way in terms of how our political culture functioned. And so I thought the crisis that I saw in our political realm necessitated my doing work beyond just individual cases, and that defending constitutional liberties could be best done by political writing and mm-hmm. the sort of thing I've been doing the last several years rather than litigating individual cases.
And much of your writing lately has been about the FISA court, and there's been a lot recently. There's a legislation being negotiated in Congress now. Could you catch us up on that? Tell us what's the latest is.
Sure. FISA, as it existed in 1978, has been amended many, many times to accommodate modern technology and the like. Of course, after 2005, when it was revealed that the president was spying on Americans without warrants in violation of FISA, the president has repeatedly demanded that Congress pass a new law essentially legalizing the illegal program that he had ordered in secret. And in August of 2007, Congress got together and passed the Protect America Act, which did, in fact, legalize large amounts of the warrantless spying that the president had ordered. And the one thing that the Democrats did that was worthy of some commendation was that they inserted a six-month sunset provision because the administration was telling them, if you don't pass this law immediately, we're going to be attacked by the terrorists while you're on recess and the blood will be on your hands. So they said, okay, well, we'll pass this law, but we'll put a six-month sunset provision in so we can revisit it when the terrorists aren't about to attack tomorrow. And so in February, when the time was just about up, the Senate passed an extremely draconian law written by Dick Cheney and Jay Rockefeller, which not only copied the Protect America Act, but went even further, and it also immunized the telecoms that had participated in the illegal spying program from any liability or being held accountable in a court of law. The House looked like they were about to pass the same bill, and at the last minute, the Democratic caucus stood together, refused to pass that law, passed a much better law on their own, and since then, there's been a lot of pressure on the House and the House Democratic leadership to pass the law that the Senate passed that would dramatically expand warrantless eavesdropping and immunize telecoms, and they constantly look like they're on the verge of doing that, but at least thus far they haven't.
Why is the issue of immunity so important? You've written about it as it being unacceptable to give the telecom companies immunity. Why is that such a crucial point?
Well, it's crucial for two reasons. One is it's crucial because we cannot have a system in which the rule of law is applicable only to one class of citizens, whereas the richest and most well-connected corporations are free to break our laws with complete impunity. And when they're caught doing so, have Congress pass a special law saying that even though you've broken the law in the past, you need not be held accountable in a court of law. I mean, the rule of law ceases to exist if corporations and political officials are allowed to break our laws and then be immunized for it retroactively after the fact. But the equally important reason is that every avenue for finding out what our government has done with the telecoms in terms of how they've been spying on us has been foreclosed. The media has hardly investigated. Congress has voted not to investigate. The courts have, in lawsuits brought against the government, repeatedly dismissed those lawsuits on various technical and legal grounds. And so the one remaining avenue that's left for us to find out about what actually happened are these lawsuits that have been brought by customers against the telecoms with the ACLU and other organizations as the counsel. And that's the main reason why the administration is so eager to have these suits stopped, because they will ultimately lead to the disclosure of what these spying programs entailed, and as importantly, will lead to an adjudication as to whether or not the law was broken here.
Sort of like getting Al Capone for tax evasion, I guess.
I mean, it's an indirect way for holding government leaders accountable, but it's a potentially potent one.
Now, your critiques of the administration focus on use of executive power often, and I'm wondering what it will take to correct that in your view. Is it a matter of the next president just behaving himself, or do we need to actually legislate our way out of things that have been done these past couple of years?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of those things. I mean, one of the most universal truths of political leaders is that once they acquire power, they tend not to give it up voluntarily. And so it's possible that there will be a new president who will repudiate some of these theories of presidential power and will voluntarily accept limits on how he can exercise presidential authority. But I don't think that's very likely, certainly not in a fundamental way. And so certainly legislation is necessary to curb some of these radical incursions into how our government functions. But I think more than that is a demonstration on the part of Congress, which is really the American people acting through their representatives, that a demonstration that they have the political will to compel political leaders to abide by the law and that there will be punishment and consequences if they fail to do so.
And what will you be looking for in the very early days of the next administration?
Well, I'll be looking for things like whether or not there's a repudiation of the Justice Department of the multiple memoranda that still are in existence, still are valid, written by John Yoo and David Addington and others, which essentially proclaim that the president has the authority to act outside of any concept of law. I'll be looking for a rescission of some of the executive orders and signing statements reserving for the president the right to violate all sorts of laws that have been passed. And I think as importantly is some sort of rhetorical declaration by the new president about his understandings of the limitations of that office.
Are we hearing the adequate dialogue about this in the presidential race thus far, or do you expect to?
No and no. You know, it's amazing how these issues lie at the heart of almost every significant political controversy of the last 7 years. And other than a questionnaire that was circulated by Charlie Savage at the Boston Globe in December of 2007, which asked all the candidates their views on all these various executive power issues, those issues have been missing almost completely. They've been almost entirely invisible from the current election. The media is uninterested in them, doesn't much understand them, doesn't want to do the work to understand them. And so I don't expect that the candidates will be pressured to pay any more attention to them than they've paid thus far.
Now, I read on your Wikipedia page that you split your time between the United States and Brazil.
Right.
Because your partner is, he's Brazilian, and
right.
Brazil recognizes your same-sex relationship.
Right, that's right.
I want to talk to you about the California developments. Is this California being California? Can we expect to see this in more states? Is it enough?
Well, I mean, in terms of the question that you asked about my personal situation, the reason why American citizens who are in partnership, same-sex partnership with foreign nationals, are unable to live in their own country if they want to live with the person who they want to share their life with is because the Defense of Marriage Act, passed during the Clinton administration, bars the federal government from recognizing or extending any benefits to any same-sex couples of any kind. So the federal government is barred by that law from extending immigration benefits, for example, that are based on marriage to same-sex couples. So even if every state in the union, including California, ends up recognizing gay marriage, it won't have any effect on the federal prohibition on extending marital benefits to same-sex couples. That law would have to be repealed in order for that to happen. But obviously, having states recognize same-sex marriages and extend marital benefits, as California did, as Massachusetts has done, as other states are clearly prepared politically to do, is of great benefit to the same-sex couples in those states in terms of getting benefits that are distributed by the state.
But that's interesting. This is actually an immigration issue of sorts.
Well, that's right. I mean, most, you know, if an American citizen marries someone of the opposite sex who's not a citizen of this country, citizenship is essentially automatic so that they can live with their spouse in their country. Most civilized countries in the world now have a similar recognition for same-sex couples because they don't want to put their citizens in the horrific predicament of choosing to live outside of their own country or live apart from their spouse. Brazil was a military dictatorship until 1985. It's a third world country. It's the largest Catholic country in the world, the largest Catholic population in the world, and yet its government recognizes same-sex marriages. I can get a and have a permanent visa in Brazil based on my relationship, but my government will allow my partner only to have a tourist visa to enter the United States.
So he can't stay here for more than...
For more than 3 months at a time or 6 months in a year. He can't study or work either.
Have you been tempted to move to Brazil?
Well, I'm spending a good deal of my time in Brazil, and I would say largely live there, yeah. 9 months out of the year, because being with my partner is the most important thing, as it is for most people. And so, you know, there's pending legislation and the like to repeal that part of the Defense of Marriage Act and to start extending immigration benefits to same-sex couples, but it's not at all certain that it will pass anytime soon.
But we've read stories about people moving to Canada when Bush was reelected and things like that. You decide to stay, even with this travel that you're forced to do.
Well, I'm an American citizen, and the last thing that I would ever do is allow radicals who don't believe in our constitutional framework to transform the country and force me to move out. So obviously a good deal of my time and energy is devoted to defending those values that are under assault, and I anticipate that I'll continue to do that, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Great. Glenn Greenwald, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Voices from the 2008 ACLU Membership Conference. You can hear more of these conversations at the website aclu.org, and you can subscribe to the podcast feed through the iTunes Music Store. Just search for ACLU. This is Matt Dellinger.